We'll take a moment and review for some of you that were not here yesterday. Again, I'd like to emphasize that what we follow will be the scriptures regardless of human research. And yet I think it's fascinating when one looks at long-term research, compares it with the Bible, and when you pour everything in the crucible of the scriptures and then take what belongs there and what fits, I think you make progress. First of all, we would like to remind you again of some of the basic scriptures we all are familiar with. Proverbs 22 and verse 6, about training up a child in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it. To fathers, to not provoke their children to anger. And I think a lot of times fathers need to pray about that one right there. I found out many men have a very difficult time differentiating between teasing and provoking. And I've often thought that God said that to men because that's far easier for men to fall into that extreme than it is for women. But bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. And then in Titus 2, 3, and 4, older women are to teach, encourage the younger women to love. And here the word love is that word phileo, meaning to show affection rather than the agape kind of love that regardless whether you have affection or not, do what's right. This one, though, is to show affection. It mentions to the husband and to their children. And those that were here yesterday, we noticed the importance of affection from secular research. To show affection. That is absolutely essential. I think a lot of times, men and women, in our culture, we inhibit, we stifle affection. Somehow we believe it's a sign of weakness or that it's not good. And I hope that that will be changed, and New Testament Christians should lead the way in changing that. And then Hebrews 12, 4 through 11, we are to discipline our children for their good, not for our vengeance or not for any other purpose. And that's not easy to do either. And then the other word for love, the agape kind of love, and that certainly includes our children, that even when affection is not there, to seek what is best for them. And as we go through this, this will come up time and time again. Now, yesterday, several of you asked me, and if you'd like to find this article, the main one I'm using, this is where you'll find it, in The American Psychologist, October 1979, volume 34, number 10, pages 958 to 966. The title is Development of Moral Thought, Feeling, and Behavior by Martin L. Hoffman. And it's probably the best summation that I have seen. And it is the one that tries to summarize the 50 years of research on this. Now, to review what we covered yesterday. First of all, concerning discipline and affection. We looked at three things after the introduction. That moral internalization, remember now, that means that where it was outside of yourself controlling yourself, then hopefully it's going to move with inside yourself where you control yourself from within. And that's the purpose of raising a child morally. You cannot have a society unless that is accomplished. So how do you get this moral internalization to take place? Well, three things. The parents' frequent use of inductive discipline techniques. Well, honey, if everybody poked everybody in the eye, how would you like that? If everybody took everybody's toy away from them, if everybody knocked everybody down, if everybody spit in everybody's face. When your child does something along this line, the whole idea is they found it is very effective to go from the specific then to the general, the inductive type of reasoning with the child. And what they have found is, as we looked at yesterday, that it's tremendously effective, one of the ways to bring about moral internalization. B, the parent's frequent expression of affection outside the discipline encounter. Affection and discipline should not be given at the same time. If you have affection and discipline given at the same time, a lot of children are unable to see the connection, the cause, and the effect. And some of them in their minds, they begin to sense, well, if I misbehave, then I get affection, and it's worth going through the discipline to get the affection. And that's how it becomes connected in their minds. And this is terrible if you get on that pathway. Then, of course, instead of moral internalization, you have deviant internalization. And a child begins then to misbehave to receive the affection, even though he has to go through discipline. So there should be a break, a period of time, always. Discipline and affection should never be together, or one immediately follow the other. There should always be that period of time. And as we said yesterday, never should one be giving discipline and the other giving affection. That is disastrous. Children then will split a family wide open, house divided against itself. And a mother who starts in her father, "Oh, you poor little thing," when the other one is disciplining the child, is headed for trouble beyond degree. This cannot be done. So you must give the affection, but it's outside the discipline encounter. Now again, that harmonizes, see, with what we read in Titus. To show affection, to show the warmth, the cuddling, the look of praise, the look of adoration, to tell the child you love them. I'm constantly amazed in my work, and I am in the habit of asking even college students, do you ever remember your mother saying she loved you? No, sir. Not once? No, sir. Don't ever remember. Well, did your dad ever say he loved you? Well, no. No, he would think that'd be sissy. And I hear that over and over and over. I have kids sitting in my office and never have heard a mother or father ever say that they love them. And yet you call in the mother and father and you know what they say? Why? He had a stereo. I never had a stereo growing up. He knows I loved him. No, he doesn't know. One of the greatest errors of our time is thinking that the giving of material gifts convey love. They don't. The reason they don't, because we got a world of material gifts. All kids growing up have more material gifts than they can use. And to just keep giving material gifts doesn't mean anything. We have to learn that. There must be affection given, and given in the way that the child perceives its affection. And you remember what we studied yesterday, that when affection is given consistently, then when discipline has to be administered, then the discipline works. But if the discipline is given, but without the affection, it fails. We must understand that, but again, never at the same time. C, there's also evidence that under certain conditions, when the child is openly and unreasonably defiant, and all children, or a great majority of them, will be at times, they're going to challenge you. Part of what we call the philosophy of egoism is that all of us have the desire within us to move to become powerful, physically, socially, financially, in all different kinds of ways. For Christians, the driving power becomes to overcome the grave, to be raised from the dead. That's the reason that the cross is the magnet of Christianity, to overcome death. If that is controlled, it's fine. But if it gets out of hand, then you have maybe a sociopath who kills to do it, or a child who becomes deviant. The will to power is inside of all of us. It can go astray religiously into Phariseeism or Diotrephes. And of course, that happens from time to time. It must be controlled. Well, children are going to express that. And when they reach that point, which they probably will, openly and unreasonably defiant, then the occasional use of power assertion by parents may contribute positively to moral internalization. So spanking, other forms of power assertion, there's a proper place for them. Now, if a person only would spank a child, without the others, it will not work. Again, like everything the Bible teaches, it takes the proper mix. Just like faith only is not going to save you, or works only is not going to save you, or grace only is not going to save you. Somehow we have to internalize the proper mix and pray for wisdom to put the three together. Well, so it is with this one. Now, the parent is model. We looked at 2 points on this, which I think are interesting and fascinating. Children will readily imitate an adult model who yields to temptation. They give the example of leaves an assigned task to watch a movie, as though the model, serves to legitimize the deviant behavior. David, Ammon, Absalom. 2 Samuel 11 through 18. They will readily imitate an adult model who does what's wrong. Now, on the other hand, they are less likely to imitate a model who resists temptation. But that's all right, because that's taken care of by the first three principles. How you accomplish the moral internalization. Again, think concerning that. That's why a father and a mother have a tremendous responsibility day in and day out. What kind of a model? And don't think the children aren't learning. Most of the things we learn non-verbally. We learn by the modeling process. B, when a child who makes moral judgment of others on the basis of consequences of their acts is exposed to an adult model who judges acts on the basis of intentions, the child shows an increased understanding of the principle of intentions, and the effect may last up to a year. To me, that is a tremendous finding. Again, you can think of all kinds of illustration. Maybe a neighbor says something terrible to mother, and the child's there. After the neighbor leaves, the mother is thinking, maybe out loud, and says to the child, said, "Now, honey, it was awful tempting. I wanted to really tell her off, and I came awful close to it, but I thought about it, and I knew that if I did, then she would say something else nasty, and then I'd have probably said something more nasty, and we'd ended up in a big fight, and it wouldn't have worked." Now, when a child can see a parent behave because they're behaving on the basis of intention, applying the agape kind of love, you seek the welfare of others no matter what they're saying about you, no matter what they're doing to you. When a child sees that one instance, it may last up to a year. Do your children see that? Me and you? My children? Peer influence. Yesterday, again, we went into some depth on this one. And we now have some things here that we found from yesterday. The research indicates that parental influence wanes and peer groups become more influential as children get older. And this research suggests that exposure to a peer who behaves aggressively or yields to temptation and is not punished increases the likelihood that a child will do the same. Again, as I said yesterday, there's a reason that we must demand discipline in the school system. Peer does this, not punished, then that just is like the leavening influence. And that's exactly why in 1 Corinthians 5, the church was commanded to withdraw from the man that was guilty of the sexual misbehavior. That is essential. There is a leavening influence there. Same thing with families or whatever it is. If the model is punished, the subject behaves as though there were no model. And that person ceases to be a model. That child that's misbehaving is no model for the other children in the classroom. These findings suggest that if children deviate from adult moral norms without punishment, as often happens outside the home, this may stimulate a child to deviate. If they are punished, however, this may not serve as a deterrent. The immediate impact of the peer behavior may thus be more likely to weaken than to strengthen one's inhibition, at least in our society. But that's all right, because we have the other three things going. We have the moral internalization taking place. You can't depend only upon this one. That's the interesting thing of all this research. It takes all of it put together. Then we looked at empathy and pro-social behavior. These findings fit the hypothesis that empathic distress is a pro-social motive. And we discussed how some call it an egoistic motive, because one feels better after helping. The evidence suggests, however, that feeling better is usually not the aim of helping. When empathically aroused, older children, adults, know what they are responding to, something happening to someone else, and they have a sense of what the other is feeling. infants may be empathically aroused without these cognitions, but they can still be empathically aroused. Empathy must be distinguished from obvious self-serving motives like approval, success, and material gain. Just like as Christians, we must never do something good to receive a reward. We must do it to please God and to serve the other person that we're dealing with, and that must be our primary concern. And when we do that, then there usually is a reward, but that's not the purpose. A human attribute like empathy that can transform another's misfortune into distress in the self demands the attention of social scientists and educators for its relevance both to moral development and to bridging the gap between the individual and society. Remember what we said yesterday. The problem is, how can this child growing up learn to satisfy its needs in a way that all other people in the society in which it lives, they also can satisfy their needs and everybody can get along? Well, the New Testament ethic is the way to do it. So here, what we discussed was, it is an excellent thing to point out to the child quite regularly, honey, how would you feel? Do you remember when Johnny knocked you down and you cried? Well, you just knocked Susie down. How'd you feel? Honey, do you remember being spit upon? Remember how you felt? Well, you spit on Mary. How do you think she felt? See, this is the very basis of the new love that Jesus commanded. You put yourself in the other person's shoes. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You have to put yourself over there and then think, now how would I feel? Every preacher that preaches ought to think that. If I were sitting in the audience and this was being said, now how would I want it said? How would I feel? That's the reason if you preach without love, you're nothing. Knowledge alone, 1 Corinthians 8 says, makes arrogance. But love builds people up. Everything must be done with the idea of putting yourself in the other person's shoes. Now, sometimes it requires discipline. But you do discipline the way you'd want it done to you. If it was needed, then how would you want it done to you? See, don't ever interpret love in the Bible as just mean ooey-gooey and never saying no. Hebrews 12, love includes discipline. But it's a way of doing discipline, not for vengeance. It's for the welfare of the other. And this is what you think about with empathy. Now, if you start rearing your child where over the period of time, this accumulates all these small things until that child begins to think that way. If I were the teacher, would I want people talking while I'm trying to teach? Now see, you're moving to moral internalization. This is the basis of moral internalization. You bring forth the empathic distress. Empathy, the ability to put yourself in their shoes, to feel as they're feeling, to think as they're thinking. And if we could make all of our decisions on that, we'd solve most of our problems. I want to say something right here. I hear all the things about our religious, how we're falling in numbers religiously, losing people religiously, and all of this business. Now, I want to say what I want, what I think, and it's this. The reason we are, because we don't have our priorities straight. Love's the first commandment, the great commandment, second commandment, and if we start preaching those commandments and put them in proper order and understanding what it means in the Greek, we'll grow as never before and we'll keep people. And I believe that with all of my heart, soul, and mind. It has nothing to do with programs or anything else. I don't care what program you have. If what we're saying is not based on love, you can preach all the truth in the world, but if you don't have love with it, it's arrogance. And arrogance is going to show through. We must understand that word agape. Get our Greek dictionaries down and read it and read it and read it and internalize and study every case of the 250 times it's used in the New Testament, understand the context of it, and put it in. That's number one. If we're New Testament Christians, that's going to be number one. If we're New Testament Christians, it's going to be number one raising our children, and that's going to solve most of our problems. I believe that with all of my heart, soul, and mind. And I hope and pray we can accomplish that. Now let's turn to guilt. That's where we looked at it briefly and go into more depth here. This is some of the findings. A full guilt response appears in children as young as 6 years. A rudimentary one appears in some 2-year-olds. Discipline that points up the effects of the child's behavior on others contributes to guilt feelings. Now that's an important finding, and I hope none of you follow the false psychologist who says you should never arouse guilt in a person. That's a false statement. Now the other extreme is also false. To only control your child by guilt, to only do it, is terrible. Both extremes must be avoided. Arousal, then, of empathic distress appears to intensify guilt feelings. How would you feel if that were done to you, honey? Guilt arousal is usually followed by a reparative act toward the victim or toward others. When neither is possible, a prolongation of the guilt results. That must be taught to be followed through. Zacchaeus understood that. Lord, if I've taken it by wrong means, I'll repay fourfold. You carry an awful lot of luggage around with you emotionally if you don't try and make it right. We need to have that understanding, make it right. Don't let the sun go down. You have it with somebody else, go to that person, Matthew 5. You've offended them, you think they've offended you, either one, Matthew 5 or 18, you go. Don't carry around that emotional luggage of guilt. Get it taken care of. You want to have happiness and peace and joy within? It's not easy, but it's the answer. And then that restoration principle of restoring, following it through. We don't want guilt to stay inside of a person. I don't know how much study you've done, but guilt is probably the center point of mental illness. Don't ever say guilt's all wrong. It's not. But it must be handled correctly, like the Bible says. Guilt arousal sometimes triggers a process of self-examination, a reordering of values, as well as a resolution to act less selfishly in the future. So many of us that were converted, not raised in the church, I think this is why a lot of times there's something inside of us that I've noticed a little bit different. You see, when you had one set of values and you came under heavy guilt, and then you changed all of your values after you'd been with them for 15 or 18 or 19 or 30 years, and you changed all of those because you know it works, it seems somehow to be more yours. I think so many kids grow up that their values are never theirs, they're mom's. They may force themselves to follow mom and dad, force themselves, but they're never really theirs. They really don't believe in them, that they work. I think this is the reason, you see. Now, what happens too, unfortunately, is some who misunderstand the whole thing then give up Christianity to have a values that harmonize with what they're doing. As we said yesterday, that's terrible. I hope and pray that they can understand the error of that. But we must always compare everything that's taught with the Scriptures and make sure the Scriptures are authority, not what some man says. There's a lot of neurotic guilt in the brotherhood, too. Guilt, there isn't any reason to have guilt. Well, let's go a little bit deeper now on that. Conscience and guilt. Hensley and Campbell, 1970. The function of conscience is to warn the ego to avoid the pain of intense guilt feeling. God made us with a conscience. That's a process of thought. Now, you can operate all day long and never find one inside of you, but it's a process of thought. And we all have it. And it hurts. Warns the ego to avoid the pain of intense guilt feeling. Walters, 1974. Conscience is common to all people in all cultures. Accumulated evidence indicates that no primitive people is without conception of right and duty. Romans 2:14 must be harmonized with all the other scriptures. When by instinct they do the will of God, the law of God. There is something innate within us my Bible tells me about right and wrong too. Well, I know most of conscience is a result of being taught. It's not all either or, it's both. A sense of right, a sense of duty. It's there. This is the reason that if we understand this, and a lot of our preaching takes place, that's the reason so many of you maybe have found something in C.S. Lewis you haven't found in other books. Because that's what he zeroes in on, right there. That's why many of you have had great success maybe with highly intellectual people when they're in an atheistic or agnostic world. And I've had the same success. You have the person read Mere Christianity. Because he deals with that very thing. And there are many people out there, they aren't like, they're not concerned about the questions of inside Christianity. They're concerned whether there is a God or not. And you have to begin there with those people. And all of us that work at State University, of course, we deal with it all the time. Because that's our biggest problem. This should be Friedman, Kaplan, and Sadek instead of Kaplan, Friedman, Sadek. 1972. Guilt begins developmentally with parental disapproval. It may be a mother holding an infant, and the infant does something she doesn't like, and her muscles tighten. We know that the baby's muscles tighten too. All of you mothers know that. If you're upset, the baby's upset. If you're irritable, the baby becomes irritable. It's communicated non-verbally by even muscle tone. The sound of the voice, the difference in the sound of the voice, the non-verbal irritation, hostility, being anxious. The baby receives the same message, non-verbally. And then, of course, it goes to the verbal. It begins developmentally with parental disapproval, and then it becomes internalized as conscience in the course of superego formation, or what you'd and I would simply say, the formation of should I or should I not? When's the proper time to do this? When's not the proper time to do this? Guilt has normal psychological and social foundations. Now, that's the way psychologists should teach it. Guilt has normal psychological and social functions. But spatial intensity, or the other extreme, absence of guilt, characterizes many mental disorders such as depression and antisocial personality to respectively. Now, put that on a continuum line, such as I've done. Continuum line is simply a line with degrees in between, with two poles that are far apart as you can get. Paul referred to those whose conscience is seared with a hot iron. Psychology calls them sociopaths. They have an absence of guilt, and they have too little guilt. They can knock your head off and sleep like a baby. It does not bother them one bit. They can put a gun to your head and blow your brains out. It makes no difference. Because in the course of developmental, they have not had the normal development of guilt. These are sociopaths. You cannot have society. It is absolutely essential that we have the proper development of guilt. I think the Sadducees were moving in that area. They denied angels, they denied the Spirit, they denied the power of God, they didn't know the Scriptures. They had lost their faith in a Creator that they must answer to. Anytime you do that, your morals and everything else starts going downhill. Now let's go to the other ditch. What about, they use the word spatial intensity, or we would say too much guilt, or guilt over things that they shouldn't feel guilty over. Now here, again, be warned. Never, never control your child by this spatial intensity of guilt. If you don't get in there and make up your bed, I'm going to call the policeman. Or every time they're going down the highway, you're talking too much. You see that highway patrolman up there? I'm going to stop and have him get you. Now, you keep up that, and you get accumulation of that in that boy, that little boy or little girl's mind, and they're going to get like this all through life. It'll affect every part of their development. Now, usually what you get the first thing is high anxiety. The brain is like this. They're scared of their own shadow. They're scared of the dark. They're scared of everything to a high degree, more than normal. Oh, you've got them under control, but I don't think you want the results. Somewhere along the line, anxiety, then often they go into total. It's just like a rubber band that's stretched and stretched and it's just shaking, and then all of a sudden what happens? I mean, you may let go of it, and what happens? It drops. It doesn't even come back to normal, does it? Now you've got depression. Why try? Go around like a zombie. You look like a dead person. No gleam in the eye. Sit in the house. Stay in bed. Don't want to see people. Keep the blinds drawn. Refuse to eat. It's useless. It's hopeless. Worn out all the time. Always sighing. Is that what you want? Too much guilt. That's exactly why Jesus condemned Pharisees. You see, they really relished. Did you wash your hands? Did you wash your hands when you came back from the marketplace? You're a sinner!
Please run this cassette fast forward to the end and turn it over for side two.
Did you keep the other tradition of the Father? Oh, they enjoyed that. Just pounding the people, pounding, making them feel guilty, 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 guilty. Jesus came to the world and he didn't pay any attention to them. He said, in vain do you worship. The worst scathing rebuke in the world was given to Phariseeism, and the reason is because what it does to human beings. There is no peace, there is no joy, there is no grace, there is no forgiveness in Phariseeism. It's a terrible thing to see happen to young people, and I've seen it too much. It leads some of our young people to suicide, and I know what I'm talking about. Preachers and elders have a tremendous responsibility to make sure no Bible class teacher, no preacher stands in our pulpit and binds anything on the people unless God has bound it upon the people in the New Testament. If we don't understand that, we will drive people from the cross. Oh, for a while it's so great and it's so wonderful, but after a while it just all falls apart. It will not work. Now you've got two ditches. It's like so many things in the Bible. Christianity is a narrow pathway. There's a ditch on the right-hand side and a ditch on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side is what we call Phariseeism. On the left-hand side, Sadduceeism. Raising children, you've got two ditches. You have too much guilt put on the child, won't work. You have too little guilt, it won't work. So we pray for wisdom to avoid both extremes. Someone says, how do you avoid both extremes? By knowing they are there. That's how you do it. And if you don't believe they're there, I'll guarantee you, you'll end up in one of them. If you don't know they're there. Because, see, our American way of life is this. Well, now let's see. If I did this and it brought forth some good, then if I did it 10 times, I'll be what? 10 times as good, right? That's how Americans think. In everything you do, you keep going like that, and finally you fall in the ditch. There's a ditch on either side. We must avoid both extremes. As the rearing of our children, we want to avoid special intensity or the absence of guilt. And then as the child is growing, we must communicate grace. And this takes wisdom. Oh, it takes wisdom. Oh, it takes wisdom for parents to know when to do like God does to you and me. You sin, it is wrong. I forgive you, and I'll never say any more to you about it. It's all over. It's just like it's never happened. But you take a parent who keeps reminding a child and reminding a child and reminding a child and reminding a child, then you're headed back to that thing over there. Grace must actively be included. They must see it in parents. They must see it between mom and dad. So the extremes, and this is the next point I want to make, extremes do beget extremes. I have seen some over here fighting it, fighting it, fighting it, fighting it, and all of a sudden, they throw away, say, Christianity, if that's what the case is, and they're as far away from it as you can imagine. Haven't you seen some preachers like that? Haven't you seen some members of the church that you wondered, how in the world could they ever do that? We're way over in one ditch, and when they started changing, where'd they stop? Other ditch, right? And then sometimes you get people over here, and then they switch over in that. And that's, of course, when you get into cultism right here. That's how cultism comes. You take a child, boy or girl raised, say, and goes to a state university, and again, I know what I'm talking about. And they never have any value system. And then they become a Christian. One of the greatest dangers is to keep them out of that ditch. They become oppressive, dogmatic. They become just overbearing. They are going to control everybody else's life. They're going to tell them when to sneeze. Go the other day. God forbid. Phariseeism was a terrible thing in raising children any place else. Now let's go a little bit more on that. So guilt. A person's conscience condemning him or him for his thoughts, speech, or action, or the lack of them, which are out of harmony with his internalized value system. Now, from significant others in your life, mother, dad, friends, and the Bible through these people, putting it in the Christian context, or you can think of Bible school teachers or substitute mothers, substitute fathers, so on and so forth. Then if throughout life, these things we've studied, and then the negative of these things, this begins to slowly become internalized. Starts over here where your child is born with very little, just a sense maybe of the right and wrong, what we said. Now it begins to move. And then it becomes fully internalized. The part of the others becomes your value system. You're like, if my nose started running, I'd probably reach back there, take out that thing, put it up. Afterwards, some of them might say, your handkerchief was dirty. You probably wouldn't say it, but suppose you did. And I'd say, how do you know? I said, you blew your nose. I did. I didn't know I blew my nose. Well, you did. Now, I want you to think about that and then think about this. I might say, oh, that's so much a part of me, I didn't even think about it. I wasn't born with it back there. Mother says it took 26 years to get that one internalized. I'm not sure. Maybe earlier than that. But finally it became internalized, you see. I don't even have to think about it, see. You just do it from within. Mother's not saying, Robert, blow your nose. Everything, well, not everything. Most of the things that we have in life, that's how it occurs. The main duty of parents is to go from almost no internalization morally to where the internalization moves on the inside. And they start acting as if there's just no other way to act. There's no other way to act. Now you have it made, don't you? Now you have your success as a parent. Now you're ready, when you die, it's okay, your children can take care of themselves, huh? Now you've accomplished one of their purposes. They are now independent. It is extremely difficult to separate the Bible message from the persons through whom we hear it. Last night they did something. I want to do it right now. I want this, this may sound a little bit different, but I want to just do something. You all help me out on this. I want you to think, how did you all become a Christian? I want to ask about six questions. By a preacher, personal work, special program, or gospel meeting, or things like this, and then go down the line. If you'll raise your hand, this fascinated me last night in here. Primarily now, how many of you were converted by a preacher? Let's see your hand. One, two, three. Okay, about six, seven, eight. Okay. How many by radio, TV? Anybody? Nobody? Okay. How about by door knocking? Anybody converted by door knocking? Okay. How many by a personal work program? Okay, a few back there, okay. How many by gospel meeting type thing? That was how you did, dropped in or something, okay. Service, okay. How many by family? You all look around. Hold them up. You all look. All right, now how many by friends? Okay. Have I made my point? See what I'm talking about? See what we're talking about? We want to convert our children. We want to bring them up so they'll be Christians, right? You see what I'm saying? How are you going to do it? Have I said anything up there that's not in harmony with the Bible? If I have afterwards, please tell me then. If any of the results of this research, are they out of harmony with the Scripture? I'd surely like to know. It's extremely difficult to separate the Bible message from the persons through whom we hear it. It seems like it always has to come back with a human that has a relationship, and it doesn't have to be family, but maybe a friend relationship or something, doesn't it? It has to have that human element. We still have the treasure in what kind of vessels? Earthen vessels, don't we? And I don't guess it'll ever change, no matter what other programs we have, and they're all fine, and I don't want to discourage any of them, but I want us to get down to the basics. It's still going to be what? People in the congregation who make friends with other people and what? Families that what? Influence their families and so on and so forth. And that's the way it's going to be. That's how it sticks. Yakeley's research shows that most people fall away because they never form a what? Support group with other people within the church, right? Okay. On that. Oh. Let's see. We have time. Yesterday I started and I had to stop on this. Let's conclude that and then we'll go to some more research tomorrow. Concluding remarks from this research study. People often assume that their acts are under surveillance. The fear of ubiquitous authority may lead them to behave morally even when alone. This is putting it all together from what we've learned. The socialization experiences leading to this orientation may include frequent power, assertive, and perhaps love withdrawing discipline, which results in painful anxiety states becoming associated with deviant behavior. Subsequently, then the kinesthetic and the other cues, the body, when you feel anxiety coming on, result of guilt, produced by the deviant act may arouse anxiety, which is avoided by inhibiting the act. Two. The human capacity for empathy may combine with the cognitive awareness of others and how others are affected by one's behavior, resulting in an eternal motive to consider others. That's what we're after. Now you're practicing the agape kind of love, always considering others like Jesus did. As contributing socialization experiences, the research suggests exposure to inductive discipline. What if everybody behaved like that? What if everybody stole from the newspaper stand? By parents who may also provide adequate affection and then serve as models of pro-social moral action, for example, they help and show empathic concern for others rather than blame them for their plight. Reciprocal role-taking, if I were in their shoes, in his shoes, her shoes, especially with peers, may also heighten the individual's sensitivity to the inner states aroused in others by one's behavior. Humans affect other humans. Having been in the other's place helps one know how the other feels in response to one's behavior. People may cognitively process information at variance with their pre-existing moral conceptions and construct new views that resolve the contradiction. When they do this, they will very likely feel a special commitment to, and in this sense, internalize the moral concepts they have actively constructed. The first process, in one form or another, for example, anxiety or retribution by God, may be pervasive in all ages and most cultural groups. The second may also occur in all ages, though primarily in humanistically oriented groups. By the way, word of warning. Be very careful what you accuse anybody of meaning that uses that word. You ask them. Let me give you an example. Our university, I am a group of what they call a team that is, goes out in the Eastern Seaboard to conduct workshops. The dean of our college called us all together here about 3 weeks ago. And this is what the dean said to me. Dr. Rigdon, I was jumped on the other day for being a humanist. And they told me I didn't believe in God. And I resent that deeply. And I want to know who told them I don't believe in God. And I said, well, let me explain. The word humanist in philosophy means atheism. In education, it only means that you're interested in humans. Oh. Is that what it is? Please don't, because a person uses the term humanistic, start saying that they're atheists. Ask them. Words mean what the person who uses the word means for the word to mean, doesn't it? And we can drive a lot of people away from the Lord Jesus Christ by what? Assuming they mean what the philosophers mean by it. So find out what they mean. Don't cause a great blot against the Lord's church by somebody saying something they don't know what they're saying. Ask the person, find out what they mean by it. This is what it means here. The third may be true mainly among adolescents and groups for whom intellectually attained values are important. The three may develop independently, sometimes complement one another, and sometimes be non-complementary. So now we've got those three things with all of the subheadings from this article. Tomorrow, the Lord willing, we'll go into television viewing and the results from research on that. If we have time, we'll go into specifics of how to love a child and also specifics on child discipline. And then, if time, research concerning children from broken homes and also what's the main influence on teenagers today. Yeah. Yeah, a reference on the article. I'll put it up. Thank you all for being with us. I'll put this up.